Hey guys, welcome to the Challenge Podcast. I'm Coach Steve.
And I'm Coach Nick, and we're going to be talking about everything fitness, health, and the challenge.
Let's get on with the show. What's up guys, Coach Steve here, and welcome back to another episode of the Challenge Weekly Show. I'm here with...
Coach Nick,
welcome to the Challenge Weekly Show. How are you doing today?
Thank you very much. I'm really good. How are you?
I'm really well. So, you know, we are in week 4 of the challenge this week, and we are about to transition into that week 5 to 8 portion of the challenge. So we're about to go into that second phase of the challenge, which is always exciting, right?
Definitely. This is where you've got to really put your foot on the gas.
We do, because this is where the kind of like this change really gets made. Because, you know, in that first week, 1 to 4 period, everything's fun and exciting. Everything's new. If you're brand new to exercise, you're seeing lots of change and lots of gains in the gym. We've completely overhauled our lifestyle. We've done the challenge before. We're in this exciting honeymoon period of the challenge. But then when we transition to that week's 5 to 8, that's when, you know, things get tough. And that's kind of when all the changes actually get made, right? Because change doesn't really happen straight away in week one. It can take, you know, 4, 8, 12, 24, even a year worth of effort to make that big change in our life.
Definitely. That's why I think it's a great time to just take stock and celebrate what you already have achieved, celebrate any new patterns and routines that you put into place, and just keep going with that, because those will be established by now, which is fantastic, because it does take about 4 weeks just to rewire your brain to go into that sort of a routine. So you're really on your way now, which is, it's wonderful to see. I like this phase.
Definitely is lots of fun in this phase, right? And, you know, in that week 4, so this week here, we open up our week 4 check-in process. So within that week 4 check-in process, you'll be invited to upload a progress photo of yourself. So you don't need the entry document, that Max or Maxine document or the newspaper, anything like that. You can just take a selfie in the mirror. But it is a great time to reflect on your journey so far. So in that 4-week period, comparing your start photo to that week 4 photo, it can be a really big change, right? Especially if maybe some other things aren't changing in your life. Maybe your training isn't going up really highly, or your body weight isn't changing a lot. But looking at those photos can be a really big eye-opener, being like, wow, like my body has transformed so much over 4 weeks. Imagine what else you could do over the next 8 weeks of the challenge.
Yeah, and it's really also about taking stock of how your environment is going as well, and just making those little tweaks just to really crank it right up.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. There are always ways that we can modify our program, or we can increase the intensity, or sometimes strategically decrease the intensity so that we can keep on going. But look, you know, in this time of this recording, Nick, it is week 2 of our 1-week lockdown in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And I think everyone in Melbourne is feeling that little bit of fatigue. I know that you're homeschooling at the moment. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's, I don't even know if it's called homeschooling. I think it's called like remote learning. They're definitely in their rooms doing something. You know, it's kind of gotten to that point. So I guess I can take something from this podcast today and remember to, you know, stick with our routine and keep our heads up and keep going and find the joy in every single day. So I might remind myself throughout this podcast to do that as well, which would be great. So hopefully we can pep everybody up, including myself. But yes, so the kids are upstairs doing some stuff.
Yeah, I think we're both kind of lucky. We both have a little home gym set up with quite a bit of equipment that we purchased over our times. So maybe in terms of the training side of things, we might be a little bit more fortunate, in a little bit of a better position. But I think, you know, I must openly admit, like, I'm having a real tough time with this lockdown. And I can imagine that there's so many other people in Melbourne, all across Victoria, both regional and metro Melbourne, that are just having a real tough time. And I have a lot of empathy for everyone who's going through this, especially if you don't have access to a gym like I do. But even just being at home and working from home, or being in lockdown, having school kids at home. But you're right, it's all about that routine and about having some sort of normality so that we can just get through this phase.
And just celebrating, like I spoke about last night in the live, just celebrating small things every day. So for us, it might be that we have a group family trip up to the supermarket, and that's our exciting thing. Everyone can choose a piece of fruit or something, and that is fun. You know, that's our version of being fun. But, you know, you've got to do what you can. You've got to just appreciate the small things.
So, like, for me, when I get into these kind of, you know, semi-depressive states, or where I, you know, can't be bothered, you know, that lockdown fatigue is a real thing, I kind of revert to old habits that I had well before I was a fitness guy, right? So even 10 years later, these habits still are lingering deep inside of me, right? And for me, when I was younger, I was a big gamer. So I played lots of video games, right? And over the years, I have played video games. I like playing video games. And I have found myself just can't be bothered. And I just sit on the couch and just play video games. And not that this is a bad thing. It's a nice mental distraction. But it is kind of like this feedback loop where I end up just like sitting around all day not wanting to do anything. So sometimes I have to kind of break this mold of these previous behaviors that's still in with me and go do something. So that can just involve things around the home, such as playing with my dog, going outside, getting some fresh air, going for a walk, or even just doing some chores around the house, such as, you know, making the bed when you wake up, doing some meal prep, even cooking dinner, or even just like cleaning around the house, those things that you kind of put off. Like we cleaned the laundry the other day, which was a big mission. But you know, how nice does it feel when you kind of get those jobs done?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's just about sort of looking after what you can.
Now, look, Nick, let's change the tone and let's talk about some non-scale victories for the week. So I think it is always important to highlight those victories in our life that might not be related to the challenge or fitness or the scale. So, Nick, do you want to kick us off? What kind of non-scale victories have you found this week?
So, Steve, we would love to congratulate Jenna Hewlett for getting engaged. That's very exciting.
Congratulations, Jenna.
And you can relate to that. So really, it's an exciting time, such a nice thing. So just for our community to see things like that, it just makes our hearts flutter and go warm. Yeah.
And I don't know if it's technically a victory. Like, I don't know if it's a victory, but it's still awesome and great news for Jenna. So congratulations.
Yeah, it's nice, positive, love, new beginnings, flourishing, all that sort of stuff. We love it. So congratulations. It does not go unnoticed. And we love to be connected with the community in that way and see what everyone's doing and have a sticky beach. So that's really cool. And then, yeah, my one is just a little bit broader as well, of just a few of our regular women who have sort of really been at the forefront of the challenge for quite some time and now having a go at muscle gain and what that means for them, that they're kind of sharing the process. They're sharing that some days they might not, you know, see as many veins in their arms as what they've previously seen, but they also know, as we've mentioned a few times, if you just keep going in a calorie deficit, where do you go? You can't sort of fade away to nothing. So you do have to rebuild. And I think it's a really courageous thing to do. And it's something that if you've never done it before with muscle gain, it's uncharted territory. You have to put your trust in a lot of different things. And I think everybody coming together as a collective, just celebrating that has been fantastic to see, because it's going to really then enable other people to have the courage to give it a go as well, which I think that, you know, you always have to find the leaders and sort of emulate them. And, you know, I'm very much, very much all about that. I have no fears around it anymore. I have goals around it. So I'm always available for people to chat to if they have any worries about that. That's probably one of my favorite things to do, is just get bigger. I think, well, I'll just get off my soapbox in one second, but for women, we've been told, I think, for so many years, get smaller, be less in a way, even with fitness, you know, do that. But the thing is, what if we want to get bigger, stronger? What if that's really cool too? I think that that's something that we need to constantly question and go, you know, what do we need to do to be our best, biggest selves? It doesn't mean bigger spatially necessarily, but it just means looking for bigger, going for bigger and aiming higher.
I love that. And I definitely agree, where fitness for women has always been, you know, be smaller, be leaner, be skinnier, right? And even in just marketing, and you see it in fashion and on movies and TV shows and stuff, it's all about being skinny, skinny, skinny. But I love where fitness is pushing women at the moment, or directing is probably a better word, to go, well, let's get stronger. And both as a fitness professional and a healthcare professional, we know that there's so many benefits to being stronger. Not so much, you know, there's one side of mental side of things where we go, okay, yeah, you're more confident, you know, more outgoing, or yeah, this is great. But then also from a physiological side, we go, yeah, you know, the muscles, we have more muscle. We fight this thing called sarcopenia, where our muscles slowly, you know, waste away as we age, right? Normal aging process. And then also for women around osteoporosis, where our bones become weaker, if we are completing resistance training, focusing on getting stronger, we fight those changes in our body to maintain that bone mineral density, so that we reduce our risk of breaking bones. We reduce the risk of, you know, having those hip operations that, you know, just almost normal language. It's like, oh, you're 60, when are you getting your hips done? It's like, well, we can go through a process in our life where we don't have our knees replaced, don't have our hips replaced, and we could do it now by focusing on getting stronger. So I love that that's becoming a more of a normal conversation for everybody within women, men, everyone. It's awesome to see.
Yeah, that's right. That's the other thing I should say. It's not just the women. There's also, say, our grand champion, Sel, as well. He's going through now a muscle gain process as well. So if you want to jump on board the muscle gain at any point, it's probably a good time because, yeah, all of our kings and queens in there are giving it a crack. So it's a really good time to feel comfy to experiment and push the boundaries with your body.
So I've got a few non-scale victories for the week as well. One thing I love doing in the challenge is going through the journals. So on the challenge website, you have access to a journal where you can write anything you like. You can upload a photo, you can do a fitness test, you can do a check-in, anything you like on a journal. And this is actually a really cool way to reflect on your journey of the challenge. So you can see other people in the challenge posting on their journal and might be a great way to kind of relate to other people where we're in week four. Some people might have you having a challenging time in the challenge and seeing somebody else in a similar situation can be a really positive thing. Being like, okay, I know that this person's struggling. I'm struggling. I'm not alone. And there are always good wins that come out of the journal. So if you haven't already, go make a post on the journal or go check out the journal. So you could see that under the journal tab on the challenge website or under the community tab, as in the latest journal post as well. When I was looking through the journals, it was almost 1, 2, and 3. Three wins in a row from three different people, and it was all related to their step count, which I think was really cool. So the first one goes out to Peter Venz, V-E-N-Z, Venz, who completed over 137,000 steps in a week, which I thought was pretty cool. That's almost 20,000 steps a day, 7 days, 137,000 steps in a week. Second goes to Caroline Economendez. Her goal was to walk 10,000 steps a day or 70,000 steps in a week. And she managed to step 95,837 steps for the week. She smashed her goal, went a little bit further than that. So congratulations to Caroline. And then finally, it was Max Sessot, who completed 27,000 steps in one day and 112,000 steps in a week. So big congratulations to the three of them and congratulations to everybody who are keeping track of their step count, because we know that that daily energy expenditure through our steps, or what we call NEATs, or non-exercise activity thermogenesis, is super important because that's where we expend the majority of our energy throughout the day. Because through formal exercise, like doing our squats, doing our deadlifts, generally expends maybe 10% of our overall daily energy expenditure. But then our normal day-to-day activities make up, you know, this 35 to 45% of our overall expenditure. It's huge.
Start to enjoy it. It's a really positive step.
You're right. So, you know, if you can find ways to enjoy doing your steps, right? Maybe listen to a podcast like this or some videos or music or something like that. But it doesn't need to be, you know, a formal thing like, oh, I'm going to go for a walk now and get my steps in. It can just be you making small decisions from day to day to increase your overall physical activity. So that could be cleaning up around the house. That could be parking a little bit further away from wherever you need to go, or taking the stairs instead of the escalator, or even just those normal behaviors. Like, let's say when you're going shopping at a supermarket, at Coles, you're in lockdown. You can either walk into Coles, go straight to, you know, grab the milk and then leave, or you may do a few laps around Coles, pick up a few items, grab your milk, and then go home. So there you've added an extra couple of hundred steps.
Like, you can really break it down into bite-sized chunks. Just go, I'm just going to do 500 extra steps around this supermarket now. It's just, it's not about seeing the 10,000 as a whole. It's just about an extra 500 here and there. Suddenly you've got 1,000. And, you know, I mean, my little trick is that if my rabbits come inside, I vacuum after them, and the vacuum cleaner is really heavy. So that I know that if I push and pull that and then, you know, walk a little bit extra, it's good energy expenditure. So, you know, I do it all the time, that sort of stuff, just in my head, just counting a few little extra things here and there that I can do.
I think it's important at this stage of the challenge to get a good understanding of our overall physical activity, because what happens when we're in an energy deficit is this concept of this adaptive metabolism. So our energy expenditure will slowly decrease as our energy intake slowly decreases. So you may find that at the start of the challenge, hey, you are comfortably hitting 10,000 steps every day, bang, 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 bang. But then maybe in this week four phase, you notice that your weekly average slowly decreases to maybe 9,000 steps. And you're like, ooh, okay. And then it slowly decreases again to maybe 8,000 steps. You go, ooh, my overall step count is slowly decreasing as my energy intake is slowly decreasing. So this is that idea of adaptive thermogenesis or adaptive metabolism that occurs in our body. We do need to make some conscious changes to this trend sometimes where we go kind of going, oh, well, I'm averaging 7,000 steps now. Why am I losing weight? And we go, well, what if we were to bump that back up to where you were in week one? Will you continue to see that weight loss occur? Okay, so it's just good information to know. So if you're not already tracking your steps, maybe you start taking note of your steps using a step counter like a Fitbit or using like an app on your phone, which can give a good guide of our overall daily physical activity. And look, if you're not hitting 10,000 steps, it's also okay. Whatever number you're at, try to do this a little bit more next week. So if you're hitting 5,000 steps every day, okay, great, good baseline. Next week, try to hit maybe 5,500, or the week after, maybe 5,600, right? So you're slowly increasing it over time. That's the main idea that we're trying to do.
That's right, because also as the calories come down just a little bit, if you are increasing even by that much, that is going to make a difference to you, especially if that's your baseline, then that's great. You know, you need to establish what works for you and just push that little bit extra. So it doesn't need to be extreme.
All right, Nick, let's move into Coach's Corner for the week. So Coach's Corner is a space where Nick and I will offer our tips and advice for the week. So Nick, do you want to kick us off? What advice would you have in the Coach's Corner this week?
I mean, I've been watching a bit on, I always look at all the Facebook and obviously the forum, but I think it's really important. And also I think just coming out of what I've just recently come out of a comp and stuff and then into the lockdown, dealing with setbacks. So how do we deal with setbacks? What's the best way to do that? Because firstly, when we start something, we always think, well, I'm not sure if this is just me, but I'm sure usually when I say something is just me, it's usually everyone. When you think nothing bad's going to happen to me, this is the one time when everything's going to go well and I'm going to start this and it's going to be perfect. A lot of us go into it with that sort of idealistic mindset. I think it's just the only way that we can see ourselves tackling something huge. It's like this time's going to be the one. And then when something happens, when something little happens, you can really easily be derailed if your mindset isn't 100% fixed on your goal, or you don't really understand why you're doing it, or you're wavering a little bit and you've got your self-confidence isn't there, or a mixture of everything. If you had some strategies to deal with setbacks, I don't know you if you do, I'm sure you do, Steve, because that's the only way that you can really get on with your body in a way as well. So like if you've got little niggles, if you miss a training session, you know, what are some strategies that you like to use? I've got a few that I tell myself, but what are yours?
Good question. For me, I read a lot of philosophy, okay? So things like stoicism or nihilism. When I am faced with a setback, I kind of take that step back from the step back. And, you know, let's use maybe the Melbourne lockdowns as an example. Firstly, I ask myself, all right, can I make a change to this? Can I impact it? Well, no, I'm one person in a sea of 6 million people. And like, what can I do about the lockdowns? You know, I didn't create this virus. All right. I can control my response to that setback. So I go, well, okay, I can either be upset at this, or I can try to look for the silver lining in this. I could be a little bit positive about this, or I can change some things about me to influence my environment. Okay, so that's very much like stoicism. All right. If we change that example to something like an injury, I actually have a little niggle in my shoulder and it's a reoccurring thing. For me, I'm a fitness professional. I'm a healthcare professional. I know what's happening in my shoulder. Still struggling to rehab it. So I understand anybody who goes through pain because it's not an easy step A, step B, step C process. But then I go, okay, well, what is this trying to tell me? What can I learn from this shoulder pain? Is it because I'm increasing my volume too quickly? Is it because I'm increasing my weight too quickly, which I do all the goddamn time, where something like a bench press, I love to bench press heavy. So whenever I start a bench press cycle, I end up increasing my weight really quickly. So I understand that I don't have the discipline to control myself when I'm bench pressing, which ultimately leads to me hurting my shoulder again. It's a cycle. So I kind of have to employ a bit of discipline with the load that I use because I know that I'm stronger than where I am. But to see progress, I do need to pull it back a little bit. And then I learn from those things, right? So I understand what's happening in my body. So just summarize what I just said and answer your question. I look and lean towards philosophy and really look at, I guess, my mindset and what I can control versus what I can't control. And that helps me with managing setbacks.
I like it. There are different ways to deal with it. So for me, I can be very ruled because I'm Italian, I suppose, very ruled by emotion. So I have to constantly remind myself about data. Data helps me. Data can ground me. So, for example, you know, my comp is finished. We'll talk about weight. Weight is meant to go up. It's actually good that it's going up. There's so many good markers about that, you know, I need to make sure that my metabolism is firing up, that I can eat as many calories as I can, you know, without changing my body composition too dramatically, too quickly. It's all there. I understand it all. But that doesn't mean, you know, also I guess because let's say the lockdowns again, other things, a little bit of isolation, you can go crazy in your head. So I have to constantly remind myself that there is another day following this day. This particular day doesn't necessarily define me. That is one set of data. Are my numbers going up in the gym? How, like for me, it's also a visual thing. How do my quads look? Do they look fuller? You know, which I like. So little markers that I have that I can rely on to take my own mind out of stuff, because I'm a very emotional athlete, which means that I can bring it when I have to, but at the same time I can be very destructive in the other way, because I can really get very hard on myself when there's no need. So for me, and I reckon this is a lot of people, so I think a lot of people probably resonate with this, I think to take my own emotion out of it and to focus on the data and just really go with that and understand that trends over time are what matter. So for me, it's very important to pull my own brain out of it and just basically get a little screwdriver and switch it to data mode and just become a bit of a robot. So maybe be a bit stoic, you know, just get on with it and don't take each day too personally. That's what I do. And that's how it ends up coming out okay somehow. But that, yeah, that's what I would do. I would say try to really disconnect yourself from emotion about this. Even though you feel proud of yourself, you might feel sad, you might feel happy, but it doesn't really help in this context. It's better to just look at your data.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about muscle gain. So similar to what you've already alluded to in this podcast already, but I guess for my coach's corner tip, I want to speak a little bit about how we can actually measure muscle gain and how we can avoid the traps that we might fall into about detecting a false positive. So you go, oh, well, my quads are getting bigger. How can you say confidently that the quad is getting bigger through what biomarkers? Okay, so let's break it down. It might be a little bit long, but I'll try and make it as succinct as possible. Okay, so when we're determining the growth of a muscle, we may first start to think about, all right, well, if I want to grow my quads or grow any muscle group, I need to increase the size. We may be looking at markers such as our weight to determine the growth of muscle. Now, we know that our weight or our body mass on a scale, so we're using a scale as an example, can sometimes be misleading. So let's say myself, I've been going through a mass phase for probably a good 12 months now. So I have gained quite a bit of weight, but I've also gained quite a bit of body fat along with that process. Firstly, am I concerned about that? No, not really. I know that I need to have a little bit of buffer within my body mass so that I can continue to see growth over time. That's okay. When I look at the scales, and previously I might have been, I don't know, 90 kilos, and then now I'm 100 kilos, can I say confidently that I've gained 10 kilos of muscle? No, that's highly unlikely. I can't have gained 10% of my body mass in pure muscle over 12 months. We know that we gain the majority of our muscle in about a 2-year period of actual focused training. Sometimes that 2 years of focused training happens after like 5 years of fluffing around training. So you may get your kind of 2 years of good training over like a 10-year period, but most of us see good results in this kind of like 2-year kind of window. So someone like myself who's been training for 10 years plus, all right, I'm not going to see the same results as I did when I first started over this year period. Firstly, when we're looking at scale weight, it can be a little bit misleading because it can be simply water, it can be simply body fat, it can be things like gut residue. And we know that there's a few variables that manipulate that number, such as, let's say, creatine. If I'm taking a creatine load, I'm holding more water in my muscle, I'm going to be heavier. If I'm eating more fruits and vegetables, increasing my fiber intake, I'm going to have more stuff in my gut. So then I'm going to be heavier on the scales. If I'm not sleeping well, if I'm stressed, I'm going to be changing some of the hormones, holding more water, if I have more carbs, all these other factors can manipulate the number on the scale, which might not give me a good indication, am I seeing muscle growth? Okay, so that's number one. Scale weight might not be the best way to determine muscle growth. Number two, we might go, okay, well, what about our image, right? As in like looking at ourselves. Okay, that can be a good way to determine, right? If your shoulders look bigger, okay, they're probably growing. If your quads look bigger, they could be growing. But sometimes if you're unable to compare photo one from photo two, as in if your posing wasn't exactly the same, that might be misleading. If your quadricep grew by an extra 100 grams, you might not see that in the picture. Other factors that can influence the way we look are things like our hydration, because that makes our muscle cells bigger. The pump, you have a pump or have you trained recently, that's going to make your quad look bigger or your bicep look bigger. And then our glycogen stores as well. So if you've done like a carb load, that's going to manipulate the size of the muscle. So sometimes the image can be misleading as well. So we've kind of ticked off two things. The weight can be misleading. Our image can also be a little bit misleading. All right, what about measurements? Similar to our image, that can be slightly misleading where we go, okay, if I've got a pump in my bicep's going to be bigger than before my pump. Am I fully hydrated and had a whole load of carbs the night before? Okay, my bicep's going to be bigger than what it was before. Okay, so maybe the measurements can also be a little bit misleading when tracking muscle growth. Okay, so then we go, all right, well, we've ticked off three things. What about our body scans? So we're talking about bod pods, DEXA scans, BIAs, all the bits and pieces, those scales you can get from Kmart to those fancy things you could pay for. All of them have their own levels of error rates. Even DEXA scans can have error rates of up to 10, sometimes 20%. We have to approach those with a little bit of skepticism, especially when we can't make every variable the same, such as the time of day, your hydration, what food you've eaten, the temperature in the room, the humidity in your hands. Sometimes they can be a little bit misleading as well. So far, I've explained all these things that are misleading. If we kind of tick all these boxes and go, yes, 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 yes. Okay, that's kind of pointing in the right direction, saying, yes, muscle growth is kind of happening. So if you are getting bigger quads, your measurements are going up, you're a little bit heavier, and maybe a DEXA scan is saying your muscle's growing. Okay, we're kind of leading in that direction. What a better way to measure your progress with muscle growth is to track your progress in the gym. So we know that a bigger muscle is going to be able to perform better than a smaller muscle. And then, of course, we need to talk about, well, what does performance mean? Firstly, we can look at the amount of weight that we use. If your deadlift max is 200 kilos, and then you then go and deadlift 220 kilos, okay, you've grown some muscle. But that can also be slightly misleading because we know that there are factors that influence strength gains. Okay, so firstly, it could be you're a beginner. You know, in that maybe 6 to 8 week window, we get lots of neurological adaptations where the nerves get better at firing. We get these motor recruitments where the muscle gets better at contracting. We get these things called co-contractors where the muscles get better at working with each other. Then you get better at the technique as well. So, okay, maybe strength might not be the complete determinant. Maybe an example like me, I've, you know, deadlifted 230 kilos once upon a time in my life. Can I deadlift 230 kilos today? No. Does that mean that I'm weaker or smaller than I was back then? No. If anything, I've got more muscle now. So sometimes strength isn't always a direct correlation to muscle size because it's closely linked to our nervous system.
Definitely. My best deadlifts that I've ever done, I've probably been what I would consider to be actually really skinny. You know, strength and muscle size are very different. And I didn't work that out probably until about 10 years into my training because I kept thinking that because I was so strong, I would naturally look super muscular. And I didn't sort of put the two together that, yeah, that strength training actually can be very misleading.
So that ultimately leads us to our overall volume of work. Okay. So what I mean by volume, we're kind of talking mainly about the total sets that we do, not so much about the total reps that we do. Firstly, we need to define, well, what is a set? A set is a sequence of repetitions without rest in between. And a set is defined as taking it close to technical failure, where you're no longer training the target muscle. So let's say a bicep curl, you know, you could do like 10 bicep curls at 10 kilos, but then you can also do another 30 bicep curls. If you swing it around, get your shoulder in there, get your forearm, use your pec and, you know, heave it up. Okay. We're not using the bicep anymore. We're using every other muscle except the bicep. Okay. So we need to find a way to uniform each single repetition, uniform each single set, so that we are confident that we have ticked off a base unit of a set. For us to be confident that muscle growth has occurred, we need to increase the total amount of volume that we apply on the muscle. Now, you might be thinking, okay, well then instead of doing three sets of chest, let's do 20. Then I could say my chest is growing. And we go, okay, well you could do 20 sets at 20 kilos, or you could do three sets at 100 kilos. So it is this little bit of a back and forth where we go, okay, we want to increase the total amount of volume or total amount of work that our muscle is doing. And we do that by increasing the total amount of volume, and then in conjunction, slowly increasing the total amount of weight that we use as well. The limiting factor here is that we know that early on in our workout, we can do a lot more than we could do at the end of our workout. So you may go, okay, on a bench press, I can now do 10 reps for five sets at 100 kilos, but then I butcher the rest of my chest workout or whatever workout we're doing for that day. So to be confident that muscle growth is occurring, we need to look at almost all of the work that this particular muscle is doing in different factors. So take, for example, our back. We know that we could train our back in a vertical pattern, like a lat pull down, and also in a horizontal pattern, like a row. If you're seeing that you're able to lift heavier on a lat pull down for more reps and more sets, and see that you could row more in a horizontal pattern for more weight, for more reps, for more sets, then you can tick off that you are confidently increasing muscle. So as a super summary of everything I've said, there are certain biomarkers that can be slightly misleading, but we can't completely push them aside. They all kind of point in the same direction. Is your body mass going up? Yes, right direction. Are your measurements going up? Yes, right direction. Is any scans that you're doing, are they going up? Yes. Are your images making the muscle look bigger? Yes, great, all in the right direction. Is your strength generally increasing? Yes, heading in the right direction. But the big factor that we're looking for is that we're seeing progression in the total amount of volume or the total amount of work capacity that the muscle is doing, so that we know that the muscle is getting bigger over time. But that was a very long, short answer to how can we actually measure muscle growth, because sometimes it can be misleading, and sometimes we think that the muscle is growing in, you know, 2 weeks, and that might not be completely true, right? Where muscle can take years, decades to grow over time, but there might be some ways that we can measure that and be confident that muscle growth is actually happening. Because if you were to measure day one to day 365, how do you know that muscle's growing if all these factors are a little bit skewed? Okay. Are you lifting more than what you were before? Yes, great. Muscle growth is happening.
Good explanation.
Long explanation, but hopefully that was helpful if you're following along.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many variables, as you said, and it's good to have a bit of an anchor and to come back to this, and maybe people can write that down and sort of have it as a little chart and tick those things off and make sure that that's all happening. You know, you don't want to invest all your time and effort, because it takes a long time, you know, and not see that sort of progress, all those different markers. It's not just seeing, as you said, it's all about everything that's going on.
And, you know, like if I was to consider my own like mass phase that I've kind of gone through, where yes, I am seeing some weight increases. Yes, my measurements are going up and my images, I'm looking, you know, more bulky than I was. Heck, you watch some of the demonstration videos that I did a couple of years ago, I look very lean. Now I look much thicker, right? You know, I've gained visibly.
You're a meal, not a snack.
Meal, not a snack, right? And heck, you know, some people might look at that and go, well, Steve, you're just getting fat. And it's like, well, like, okay, maybe I am putting on some body fat, but I'm also gaining a lot more muscle than where I was. Am I?
Hopefully they're a bit chilled. Hopefully they're not saying that. Hopefully they're not trolling.
A bit of that mental side of things for me, where I go, okay, I no longer have a six-pack like I did before, but I'm also on a comfortable path where I go, hey, I'm happy with getting stronger and bigger right now, because I know that when I lean down, I will have changed my body, and it's taken, you know, a good, you know, 1-2 years to put that effort in.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. And once you can get to that mindset, that's where it's all going to happen, because you will do the correct things to facilitate all of that, as in eat what you are, you know, required to eat and have the, you know, you've got that mindset around that. I think sometimes just transitioning from leaning down to that mindset, there's probably a good shift of probably 6 to 8 weeks, even for me, just to feel like it's okay to go the other way, especially because as fitness professionals, as you said, you know, we are out demonstrating everything. People will look at us and go, oh, what's happening with you? You know, I mean, I'm out there all the time. And so, yeah, it's good to be able to explain to other people also what's going on in your body, because say on Instagram, when you see somebody that was, you know, show lean, and then suddenly the next minute they're ripped but still huger, that's not necessarily accurate. That's not how it's going to happen. Yeah, we're here to explain the truth.
Well, I'm excited as I go through this little strength phase that I'm doing at the moment, where I've laid down the groundwork over the past 12 months plus of volume work or hypertrophy-based work. And then now, as I kind of shift the focus to more strength training and build up my nervous system to recruit these new muscle fibers that I've built, then I can be in a position to beat you, Nick, in the deadlift.
I was going to just say, I wasn't going to say it like that, because I was going to say I was going to be nice. I feel like our programs are aligning, because I'm just about to enter the same as you. You know, I have had a lot of hypertrophy work, a lot of specialized stuff, and there's basically a lot more things here to bring to my deadlift.
Oh yeah,
you know, a lot more pieces, bits and pieces. So you just have to let me catch up, because I'm still a little bit Mr. Burns. I'm still a little bit weak. I know it. I can feel it. I know when I'm going to be on fire, and it'll be game on. We have to decide where we're going to do this, or if we're going to do it at home. We'll have to figure that out, but we might go to a gym together and film it.
We'll figure it out. Hopefully we see this competitive, emotional Italian side of you.
We need to use calibrated plates too, by the way.
I think we do.
So just saying. Like, I just want to say that.
Maybe we'll find like a deadlift bar or something.
Yeah, definitely. We can source one of those. They're the best.
They're the best.
But then people will say that we're cheating, because they're really good, the deadlift bars. But anyway, we'll figure that out. That's our issue.
Look, Nick, let's go through a few questions that have come up over the week, which I thought would be interesting to chat about. So I might kick us off about a question that comes up all the time in my experience with the challenge, which is, do I weigh my food cooked or raw? And within the challenge, we've kind of trialed a few different ways of presenting the challenge to make it as succinct as possible, where we've gone all ingredients cooked or all ingredients raw, or some ingredients cooked, some ingredients raw. And then now we're in a position where we have these nice templates where we have both the cooked weight and the raw weight. So when you look at the template itself, it'll say something like rice, white, meaning white rice, and then raw, meaning that we would measure that rice raw or dry or uncooked. Then we also have rice measured out boiled as well. So if you were to cook the rice, and that was to help individuals who might do a meal prep where they cook rice on bulk and they go, well, how much is it cooked? And that's just to give a little bit of clarity about the cooked weight versus raw weight. So if you're sitting there still wondering, do I measure it cooked or raw? We hope that you found that little bit of information next to each serving size where it says cooked or raw or grilled, whatever the information is. Most of our fruits and vegetables are measured raw in their original state, because we know that the type of food can change, again, off lots of variables, such as how long do you cook it for? How hot was the temperature? Did you boil it? Did you steam it? Did you fry it? Did you blanch it? Whatever it is, that can all change the outcome. Now, at the end of the day here, this is actually my tip, where I'm actually going to tell you that it doesn't really matter how you measure your food, okay? Right. So what I mean by this is that if you've been measuring all of your rice cooked when it was really meant to be measured raw, or you've been measuring all of your meats or protein serves as cooked, but they're really meant to be raw, it doesn't matter. It's not the end of the world, because what we've done is whatever option you've chosen, you've now just changed your energy intake from whatever number it was just to that kind of algebra equation of X. So at the moment, you're just eating X. Who cares what the number is? Doesn't matter. Who cares? Then if you're losing weight, great, happy day, stay on track. If we get into a position where we do need to modify our energy intake, great, whatever you've been doing, just eat slightly less of that, where instead of having 100 grams of cooked rice versus 100 grams of raw rice, whatever you've been doing, just have 90 grams of it. Then we can confidently say, all right, now I'm having X minus 5%. That would be our energy intake rather than an arbitrary number, because even then that number is probably wrong as well. So that's my answer to that cooked versus raw.
Yeah, establishing consistency with whatever it is that you're doing. So, yeah, that's what will get you the best outcomes, because whatever you're measuring, it doesn't, as you said, it's not really crucial. It's just about having the consistency with the measurement.
All right, Nick, we'll answer the next question. So this next question is about eating out at restaurants. And one of the challengers asked us on the forum, they were explaining that they were going out for, I think, their daughter's birthday, or they're going out to lunch with their daughter or something like that, and they love to go get sushi together. And their question was, okay, well, what can I have at a sushi restaurant that still aligns with, you know, my fitness goals? So what advice would you give that individual, Nick?
Well, I'm all over this. I'm very good at restaurants, menus, all that sort of stuff. But firstly, I'll preface it by saying there are a few layers to this. One is I will just put a disclaimer and say, if it's your daughter's birthday, please feel free to enjoy that. There's just that level. There's that layer. If it's something that, as just say you're a dad and you have this occasion with your daughter and you like to go out together, what you could do is actually just enjoy it. So what if you really want to also stay on track that day while you're enjoying it, what I would probably do is just save some of your maybe carb extra allowance, some of the allowances throughout the day to then have in your dinner meal. So I would be just having some protein in the morning, some water, things like that, and maybe just saving. So that's one tactic that you can do is like a bit of a calorie budget. So you could, just for that day, have a little bit more budget to spend at the end of the day. I mean, you don't want to sit there with a calculator in a restaurant, and you don't want to sit there with your food scales unless you're like really aiming to win. You know, if you're a winner, then if you're aiming to win, then you could. But so what I would do, just for example, in a sushi restaurant, is I'd be aware that the rice that they use to cook the sushi is actually a very sugary, quite calorie dense rice. It's actually soaked in a sugary substance. I'm not sure what it is, but some sort of a yummy thing. But it definitely makes those sushi rolls quite high in calories. So with a Japanese restaurant, what I tend to do is I look for grilled meats and veggies that may not have too many dense sauces. But there's also things like a miso soup, there's the edamame, and also sashimi. Sashimi is beautiful. If you're going to eat raw fish, you should eat it at a Japanese restaurant. So there are a few things that I would do in that situation. In other situations, what I love to do, Steve, my favorite thing to do, is to Google the menu, have a look at the menu, pre-plan what you're going to do. It often involves choosing something like I always find that there's a nice salmon on the menu, and I know that salmon is a fattier, more calorie dense fish, but if you can get that grilled and you can get it with some veggies on the side, you're laughing. You're basically joining everyone else in the meal. There's also often a steak. You can get that done without the sauce. So if you just pre-plan this sort of stuff, it alleviates the anxiety. So I will even do that myself. I will suggest to our family that we go out somewhere, you know, when we're not locked down, and I will Google the menu and know where I'm at with stuff. So you want to go for the freshest foods, the closest to the foods that you would cook when you're at home yourself. And just I would stay away from anything that says that it's fried on the menu. So if you can, I mean, this is assuming that you're not just going to live your best life for the night. But so anything that says fried is probably not the best. You want to go for grilled, steamed, or poached. So those words are our favorite best friends when we're out eating. Also, the word salad is a little bit misused, because you can put anything together and call it a salad. I could seriously put like a bag of M&Ms, two oranges, and I'm looking over there, I don't have M&Ms, but like a crumpet, and say this is a salad. So just because something's called a salad doesn't mean it's necessarily healthy
or low in calories, let's say low in calories rather than healthy. So it doesn't mean it necessarily fits your calorie budget, because it can have all sorts of stuff blended through it, say like a Caesar salad that will have your bake in it and other calorie dense ingredients. So just be aware of that. Just know that, like, a salad hack is to just double check that the ingredients are all fairly fresh and fairly on the vegetable side rather than all the extras.
If I was to add on just a few points, I would recommend that just be cautious of higher fat foods. So we know that fats have more calories per gram than a carbohydrate or a protein. So we also know that chefs love to use fats because it's tasty, right? So things like butters, oils, these types of foods find their way into the meal just to add more flavor to the meal. They're often in the form of like sauces, or sometimes they're used to grill the foods as well. So let's use an example as steak. Sometimes steaks can be really high in calories because it's fried in like an oil on the grill. So you may be able to choose to have like a dry cook as opposed to an oil-based cook. So maybe you could speak with the waiter. Maybe they're able to do that for you, where they're able to cook the steak without using lots of oils. Maybe you can order a sauce on the side so that you know how much sauce is going into that, because you can have like a really great salad, like you said, Nick, where it could just be lettuce leaves and some other vegetables and maybe some grilled chicken in there, but then it can also have a dressing that's an extra, you know, 300 calories. So you can have this salad plus another 300 calories of dressing on the top of it. So you may benefit from ordering some dressing on the side. So just being cautious of the type of macronutrients that might be in the meal, mainly when we're using lots of higher fat content foods, because that can just boost our overall calorie intake for that meal to a point where we go, oh, well, I've just blown out my calorie budget for the day.
Yeah, definitely. I think another good example of that is say avocado, where you think it's, because it's green and it's fresh, you sort of think, oh, this is a good option. But the amount of avocado that they do give you is extremely generous. And if you are to look up the calories of an avocado, you'll realize, you suddenly go, wait a minute, you could probably halve that portion size, whatever it is, on your plate that's given to you, or ask for it on the side. They will do that. People are very accommodating. The other thing, one more thing is, if you look on the menu before going, you can actually look up the leanest cuts of meat that are available within the options. So say a chicken breast, you know, you want to go for a steak that is leaner. So I probably wouldn't necessarily go for like a scotch fillet, because that's got lots of nice juicy fat in it. Mm-mm. But you can actually look that up and just do a little bit of research as though you were buying a house.
That's right. Well, if you were buying a house, you wouldn't be having smashed avo, right? Because that's the reason why we can't buy houses.
Well, there you go. That's the little thing. You got it.
I got it.
So you guys wouldn't be having your smashed avo now, because you're about to have a baby. So see you later, smashed avo.
Smashed avo is gone. But look, just touching on that conversation of fats, right? So that macronutrient group of fats or lipids or whatever words you want to call them, those food groups are really highly palatable. And it really is just hardwired into our DNA, where, you know, you could imagine that human that's roaming around the world, you know, a few centuries ago, and if they came across a high fatty food like an avocado, because it has lots of energy in it, our body is going to love that food, because it's going to mean that we survive, right? Because we can consume a lot of calories in a very small amount, which is why we have kind of evolved to love really fatty foods. And this idea gets thrown around a lot of sugar and sugar being addictive. And I don't think that's completely true. And, you know, there's a little bit of research to support that. But sugar in itself isn't addictive. If I gave you a bag of sugar, Nick, and a spoon, you wouldn't sit there and eat the whole bag of sugar. Like, sugar in itself isn't addictive. But what is addictive is when sugar is mixed with fats. And that's mainly around, let's say, baked goods. So if I gave you a really nice warm croissant in front of you, which is sugar and butter and milk all mixed together in this beautiful smelling thing, you're going to devour that and you won't be able to stop. When we look at some of the foods that are highly palatable, it's things like pizza, which is bread, because we know that's ultimately a carbohydrate, with cheese, right? And salami, because these foods are high in carbs, high in fat. They're really addicting, right? They're the ones that we punish and we just don't even, we inhale, right? Things like ice cream, high in fat, high in sugar or carbohydrate really addicting. So if we are in situations where you find yourself thinking, one, I'm addicted to sugar, you're probably not addicted to sugar. If I gave you a bag of sugar, you wouldn't sit there and eat it. What you're more likely addicted to is the mix of both sugar or carbohydrate and fat, because we love that blend, and that's really highly palatable.
Restaurants are doing their job because they're designed to be a feel-good experience. So they're not nasty places. Chefs actually work on this balance of ingredients to create that sensory, experience for you. And it's just something that when we're really being mindful of everything that we're putting into our mouths, we're taking a step back and we're deciding against that for other reasons, and that's what we need to realize, that that sensory experience is something that we're going to probably forego for other great markers in our lives, other great sensations that will probably trump those short-term feelings of happiness. And also, I think it's really good to be able to connect with friends and family in a social event without having to feel the pressure of actually also eating with them exactly what they're eating. I think that, being able to hold your own and say, which I've seen a few people do, which is fantastic, on the Facebook group, just explaining that they've gone to occasions and they've brought their own food, or they've explained to the host what they're doing. And it's okay, because people get curious, but what they really want is your company. That's what they really want. So if you can be present and available and happy and excited to see them, they're not going to care what you put in your mouth.
I want to talk a little bit about calories and calories when you are sick. Again, a common question that's not only come up this week, but has come up over multiple different challenges, is that question of, I have now become sick. Let that be, I have, caught a cold, heck, got COVID, whatever it is. Do I need to modify my caloric intake? The first thing I would say, if you are feeling sick, is to go get tested, do the right thing. And then we also have kind of learned through COVID that if you are sick, let it be from the common cold, the flu or COVID, maybe it is best to stay away from other people, stay home. And, if you are sick, don't go around to your local Coles or Woolies and cough on everything and, go to work and spread your illness. Let's be smart about these types of things. Next, when it comes to your overall calories, in theory, no, you wouldn't need to modify your calories at all, unless the level of your sickness is interfering with your overall energy expenditure. And that would be mainly influencing our NEAT, right? So our daily physical activity. If you've got like the flu or the man flu and you're bedridden and you're going to stay in bed all day, you're not going to be able to do as many steps as you did if you were feeling fit and healthy. So that means that your overall energy expenditure will decrease. Sure, there might be a few comments made by people much smarter than me saying, oh, well, if you are fighting an illness, you might expend slightly more calories, as in, to the tune of an extra 100 calories or something like that. Okay, I think that's quite negligible in this environment, but the big one would be our overall physical activity. If you're sick, you're probably not training as hard, you're probably not being as physically active, you're probably staying at home, not going to work, your overall step count will probably decrease. So then you may need to, if anything, decrease your overall energy intake to balance those effects. But I will say that if you are sick, probably your top priority is to feel healthy again, and maybe you want to forego some of your challenge experience for those couple of days while you're recovering, so that you can recover to your fullest and then get back into training, rather than sitting there trying to lose weight while you're also sick, feeling crappy, more likely to binge eat on foods. You're probably better off focusing on just making yourself feel better, recovering from that illness, and then getting back into your training.
Yeah, and I know when I'm sick, I actually don't feel like eating a lot as well. And so I won't worry too much about getting all the calories in. I'll just try and do things like have a protein shake, or if I feel like having an orange or something, if I'm naturally drawn to something like that, or a banana because it's got potassium, I will have that. I won't stress about where that fits into my plan. I will just try and listen to actually what my body might require to me to get better.
And that's a good example of your adaptive metabolism. So as your energy expenditure goes down, your body goes, well, I'm not really hungry. It's because it doesn't need as much energy.
Yeah, definitely, absolutely. Because normally I'm running around like a blue-assed fly, so I need a lot of energy. And so, yeah, the minute that I stop doing stuff, my body's quite good at saying you don't need as much as what you had before.
Nick, let's wrap it up with one last question. Maybe you could take it away. Again, this question comes up frequently of when should I make changes to my program? And this change, just more specifically, is when someone would start maybe questioning their plan, or maybe the plan isn't working for them or leading them in the right direction of their goals. At what point should an individual start making modifications to their plan so they can continue to see growth towards their goal that they want to achieve?
All right. So there are a few things with this as well. One is whatever you tweak, so we let's call it tweaking rather than completely changing. I would also say don't tweak everything at once. Tweak one little thing at a time. So we've said this in a podcast before, which is about playing all your cards at once. So what I would do is I would have a look at your trend. Let's just use this one because it's easy. Not losing any scale weight. What would I do? Firstly, I would make sure that my energy expenditure is actually up there with the recommendations. So the first thing I would do is make sure that I am getting the required amount of steps, even though we said before, try. But if you're really looking at making a change, you would have to make sure that your energy expenditure is working. So I would probably slightly increase that before dropping the calories. That would be the next thing I would maybe look at. If it's not budging, perhaps take one of the snacks out. So just little changes, not extreme changes, and certainly not, this is my opinion, I'm sure it's yours as well, not everything at once. Not I'm going to double the step count and I'm going to take away all the snacks at once, because then you actually won't be able to monitor which variable has worked, or if it works, what it's going to do is eventually stop working and then you'll have less cards to play. So I would just do minor tweaks. I would also make sure that you are training at the intensity that is required for that particular program. That's the other thing. So you just want to do a little bit of an audit. And it's a good thing to do an audit. We all do. I'm sure you do. You know, I do. I absolutely do all the time. And I always try and tweak little things, and I look back at what I've been doing, and I check, and I also check if my recovery is okay. That's the other thing that we need to look at, because as we know, the gains happen outside of the gym. So you need to look at that as well. So there's sort of a circle of things that you can look at before you make extreme changes, such as completely changing your program. Because you know what that does? That puts you back out into the sea with no ship again, trying to swim around and figure out what you're doing. Whereas at the moment, you're at least on a ship.
I like that. You have a map at the moment. Yeah, you can either just jump in the water and swim around for a while, or you can stay on the map.
That's right. And look, we all know just because people have a map doesn't mean that you're going to get to your destination any quicker or anything. It's not like that. But definitely staying on track with the map. You can have some little stops. You can visit a destination that maybe not everyone else is going to, you know, but at least you know that you're going in a certain direction. So little tweaks are what matters. And often I find with clients or anyone that I've worked with, the best thing to do first up is to make sure that your energy expenditure is actually where you really need it to be to see changes. And because just going into the gym and lifting weights isn't going to be the factor that's going to maybe shift that body weight. It is going to be getting out there and getting those steps. And as soon as people start to realize that, something really changes in them. And I remember one client that I had that actually ended up losing around about, it was a lot, it was 80 kilos. It was when she realized that walking was the thing that would really help her. And she just didn't look back. She was like, oh, I didn't realize that walking around the block was the thing that I needed to do, even though her diet was good. She was doing spin classes and things like that, but just tweaking that little thing and being honest with herself and looking at her energy expenditure was what got her weight shifting.
I have written up a really nice like flow chart, especially when we're talking about weight loss plateaus or that type of discussion. It's a nice one. You can find that on the nutrition template under the FAQ section. It kind of like, it's just a nice rubric for you to follow to determine, okay, where is my weak spot in this chain on my journey? And I think the first one is always to determine, okay, are you confident that you're not heading in the right direction? So often that's the very first spot where we kind of misinterpret our progress, where we go, hey, I'm not losing weight. And he goes, okay, well, how are you measuring your weight? Are you looking at your weekly average? Are you comparing day one to day 50 and you're comparing those two numbers? Or are you looking at this average trend? So that's probably the first area where we kind of miss the mark. Next one would be like that adherence, like you said, where if you're not following that map, there's no point in having the map. You might as well just go swim in the ocean. We need to be adherent to whatever our plan is. Then we kind of get into that realm of, all right, well, what variables are we going to manipulate? Are we going to decrease our calories or increase our energy expenditure? Often it's easier to increase our energy expenditure, where most of us, that's where the area is lacking, where we just need to do more physical activity. But then sometimes if you are doing lots, if you're doing 20,000 steps a day, training 6 times a week, all these things, you may benefit from actually just reducing the calorie intake slightly rather than trying to do more physical activity, because then that leads to symptoms like overtraining and those types of negative fatigue impacts, right?
I hope that in week 4, no one's doing that yet.
No, no. But I do agree with you though, you know, we do and we should only manipulate one thing at a time. You know, we need to be good scientists and go, well, okay, if you completely overhauled everything, how do you know if it's working? If you had a plan, made, you know, just one or two changes over the course of a fortnight or a month, test that effect, see if it works, and then make another small change and then continue that minor tweak.
Yeah, and I think also that's just a really way for easy way for people to understand that it can be quite simple. It doesn't have to be overcomplicated. And, once you hit that thing, you're on your way. And then, you know, that's where you start to preach to other people. So that's where I love to see when people suddenly realize that it was just that one little thing. Then they become like converts, you know, and then you see them go, wait a minute, everybody can do this. And that's when you know that they're on their way, you know, and I love that. That's the pay it forward effect that I've noticed in over the many, many years of training people and different experiences with people. Once you've found that one thing that works for you, it sets off this chain of events that makes everything okay. And you just experiment and find that one thing within all the parameters that you've got, not everything.
Look, Nick, let's wrap it up there. If you like this podcast, be sure to share it with a friend or leave us a review on iTunes or check us out on Spotify as well. And if you have any questions for us to answer, reach out to us either on the forum, the Facebook group, or also on Instagram as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys. See you next week. Talk to you next week.
Bye now.
Bye.